baseball fans, and welcome to a podcast to be named later. I am your host, Chris Mitchell, and we've got an interesting show today. Rob Nyer is going to be joining us. I love having Rob on the program. It's always nice when you've got someone, A, who's willing to express their opinions. They're willing to be critical, but also complimentary. They're not biased one way or the other. They just plain are blunt and bold and honest, straight from the hip, so to speak. But also that they're informed. Because in this day and age of social media, and with all the websites that are out there reporting on sports and doing podcasts and all these different things, just because they're talking loudly and saying bold things doesn't mean that they actually know what they're talking about. But I've found over the years in dealing with Rob and reading his articles, he's very well informed. He's a stats guy, but also he's able to bring an insightful kind of analysis to what those stats mean. And not everybody can do that either. It's not so easy to bring numbers to theory and things like that. So I always like having Rob on. He's going to be on here in just a moment. And we've got a lot to get to today. We got about 45 minutes with Rob. We don't want to take too much of his time, even though in the past, I believe the first time he came on the show, which kind of shocked me because he came on the show the first time. I kept him here forever, and he's still willing to come back on. So I gotta be happy about that. But I think he talked for maybe as much as 2 hours the first time we came on. And that is a long, long time for a podcast, especially with people as busy as Rob is. So it's great to have him on the program. I'm going to talk a little bit about 2016 in Major League Baseball. We're going to look ahead to 2017 as well. Look at the hot stove a little bit because I do want to get Rob's opinions on what happened and what is going to happen and who needs to do what and those kinds of things. I'm excited about having Rob on to do that. I'm going to get his opinions on some of the stories that happened in baseball this year. We'll talk about a little bit about StatCast and exit velocity. I didn't really get a chance to talk to Rob about the topics on the program. I did send him a last-minute rundown. But with StatCast and exit velocity becoming more of a part of our vernacular these days, we've been talking about sabermetrics and advanced metrics and Moneyball and all of these things for quite some time now. But now StatCast has become a relevant part of analyzing baseball and exit velocity. I don't know if it's just a glossy, pretty way of saying, wow, this guy hit it over 100 miles per hour off the bat. I don't know if they're just doing that because it looks good, you know, chicks dig the long ball kind of thing, or something can be said about what exit velocity means in any real way. That's my real question. Because obviously if you hit it well with a lot of exit velocity, you hit it pretty well. Well, if a ball goes out of the park, isn't it usually hit pretty well? But what I want to ask Rob is there something to look at that actually tells us something about baseball? Is someone who hits it with better exit velocity more often, does that absolutely mean that they're a better hitter? Or is it too selective? Is the sample size too small? So we'll get into some of those things with Rob as well. Ask him his opinions on the stories of the season. We'll talk about the awards a little bit. We're going to talk about the different awards. The Rick Porcello Cy Young was a controversial one, to say the least. Picking Mike Trout over Mookie Betts, I don't think was a horrible decision. I'm a Boston guy. I would have loved Mookie Betts to win that award, but I think there's at least something to be said about that one that's not straight up. If we have time, we'll talk a little bit about the DraftKings and FanDuel merger, as well as the election. This is a lot to get to, and we've only got about 45 minutes, so I don't know what we're going to get to and what we're not going to get to, but we'll do the best we can with the time we're given here today. If you want to follow us online, if you want to follow me, Chris Mitchell, it's at CJMitch73. If you want to follow Rob, and I highly recommend you do that, it's at Rob Nyer. But let me bring him into the program right now. Rob, great to have you on board. How's everything going on out there in the West Coast?
It's going well, thank you.
Lots to get to. Season obviously over. The hot stove is in full swing, I guess, now. Let me ask you real quickly before we get to some of those topics that I kind of rambled off on there is this one of the worst free agent classes you've ever seen? And is that a good thing for baseball? The fact that there are less people for more expensive, higher profile kind of organizations, there are less guys to buy, less quality players to purchase. Is that a good thing if you actually believe that has something to do with why this free agent class is pretty thin?
I think it's on balance probably slightly better than not for baseball. I think that it can become an issue when there is a perception that the richest teams are buying all the players. I'm not saying that's actually happened very often because it hasn't, and it certainly hasn't worked out very well when it has happened. But there is that perception, and that's all people want to talk about. Now, on the other hand, a lack of high-profile players on the market means a lack of big news. And I'm sure that there are people who work at Major League Baseball who are worried about the lack of headlines this winter. But, you know, this, like all things, shall pass. And I think ultimately, if a relatively weak market means money is less important as we get into next season, I think that's ultimately a good thing for the game.
Yeah, the fact that, again, baseball is tricky because they don't limit organizations in many ways. They do in some ways. In the amateur market, to some degree, they try to minimize the foreign market, I guess you would say. They try to minimize how much teams can spend, or they try to penalize them if they do overspend. I don't know if there's a significant impact on that or not, but they don't do a lot in a lot of places to try to minimize teams throwing around their financial might. But obviously we have seen that throwing that around doesn't necessarily mean a whole lot. How big of a deal? I remember starting my podcast, I don't know, it was probably 10 years ago now, where the Red Sox and the Yankees were the biggest spenders, and they also looked like they were going to be the best teams. And while the Red Sox had a few good years in there, and the Yankees have stayed competitive, like you said, it hasn't actually worked out all that well. Is advanced metrics and the way the teams are now analytically looking at players, is that level the playing field to the point where you can be efficient and you can spend at a low level on actual players? And those are the only expenses we really see. We see these huge contracts. We don't see what they're spending for the most part on their executives. We don't see what they're spending on their analytical departments. I mean, and even if we know them, it doesn't seem like anyone cares to write about them. Because analytics are getting so big, is that impacting and leveling the playing field more than any financial impact could possibly have done?
I don't know. Theoretically, that could happen and probably has to some degree. It was also suggested, it certainly was by me, that the rich teams would also clean up on the analytics side, if only because they could afford to pay for the best analytical talent. They could afford to build the biggest analytical departments. And, in fact, that's happened. The Dodgers have a huge analytics department. The Red Sox have a gigantic analytics department. And I'm sure there are some other rich teams that do as well. Now, it's also true, of course, that the Dodgers have been pretty good the last few years. The Red Sox have been, you know, they finished last year's row, but they've been pretty good, too, for quite a while with a few blips. So I think that if you're willing to throw money in analytics, that you can have an advantage there as well. What teams like the Yankees and the Dodgers and the Red Sox are always going to fight against, though, we've seen it so many times, is that when you're one of those teams that has so much money and such a tremendous history of success, which is certainly true of the Red Sox, at least for the last, say, 15 years, basically, there is an expectation that you will win every year. And that leads often to free agent signings that look good today but don't look so great a year, 2 years, 3 years from now. I mean, look at the money that the Yankees spent and how many playoff spots they've gotten for that money in the last 3 or 4 years. How many playoff wins? How many world championships? The answer, of course, is zero. So that problem is compounded when you've given a player that much money and you feel like you absolutely have to keep playing him even when he's really not helping you on the field anymore. Now, the Dodgers have eaten a lot of that money. They seem to be very – they're not at all reluctant to give up on a player, no matter how much money he's making, if he's not performing anymore. But almost every other team, every other rich team, or poor team for that matter, seems to feel compelled to play a guy if he's making a lot of money, regardless of his performance. And that's, as long as that's the case, it's always going to be a drag on the performance of teams that try to win every year.
And you don't see, yeah, I agree with that. You definitely do not, you do seem, I'm surprised the Red Sox did that. And maybe they got lucky with the Pablo Sandoval injury, but it seemed like the Red Sox were going to be willing to eat that and bench him. And then all of a sudden, he ended up missing the season and it kind of helped them. But it was leaning towards like the Red Sox were going to sit him. But a lot of teams don't do that. And I agree with you on that.
Yeah, and I'm not sure what they were going to do with Sandoval. I mean, I think if he'd been modestly healthy and played decently in spring training, they might have played him as a replacement level guy, just because of his contract. And maybe they wouldn't have. It's hard to say, but we know there's a much if he doesn't have that contract, he's not even on the roster. And you see that time and again with players who are there simply because of the money they're being paid. You know, and it's everybody who works for these teams, everybody's familiar with the concept of the sunk cost. They understand it, but emotionally they just can't handle it. And I think in part that's due to ownership. It's difficult if you're a general manager, go to your owner and say, you know what, this guy that we owe $48 million to, we should probably just release him. That's a really hard case to make to I think most owners, maybe every owner.
It makes me think of it since we kind of went off in this tangent a little bit beyond, but Andrew Friedman was praised as a genius with Tampa Bay. The fact that they made the World Series and had some successful runs, and I think his analytical mind and the way he put together departments, it seemed like he got a real lot of credit for being one of the geniuses out there. But when you look back, the Rays had a lot of very high picks, multiple number one overall picks. And now you see what he's doing with the Dodgers. And while the Dodgers are competitive, they do have Clayton Kershaw. And I wonder, what is your opinion of Andrew Friedman? Was he a genius with Tampa Bay and he was stuck in L.A.? Is he a genius in general? I'm curious. He's one guy that I'm curious your thoughts on how good, bad, or mediocre he's been as a general manager. Because, again, I think the opinion is that he's one of the best. But I'm curious, what are your thoughts on how he's done and whether he is one of the best GMs out there or not? And they have bought a lot of their, as you said, if you're going to go out and buy an analytics department, you're going to buy all the best minds. Like you said, the Dodgers tried to do that in the front office.
They have, and they've also been very smart about the sub cost. They've just dumped salaries and not even seem to worry about it. And you could say, well, they can afford to do that. Well, some other teams could afford to do it too. They just haven't. So I think that's in part due to Friedman and in part due to support from ownership. You can't do that unless your owner says, yeah, go ahead. Do I think he's a genius? I don't think I haven't spent nearly enough time around him to know if he is a genius. I think that word should be reserved for a very few individuals in sports or any other endeavor. I don't know if Friedman's a genius. Do I believe he's one of the top GMs in baseball? I do. I think that you're absolutely right about the draft picks with the Rays. And by the way, they had some high draft picks that didn't pan out. But they did some things there that worked. And do we know yet whether or not that was luck or whether it was some particular skill that they had in, for example, keeping young pitchers healthy? No, I don't think we know that. I think that Friedman and the front office were very supportive of Joe Maddon, which was smart. I think they were smart to hire him in the first place. So you go up and down the list, and I think he checks off most of the boxes, and it probably becomes a much less interesting or at least less popular question if the Dodgers win a World Series, because that tends to cover all ills. And the Dodgers will probably do that at some point. You know, are they as strong an organization as the Cubs right now? No, probably not. But they're not that far behind. I think that heading into this past season and heading into next season as well, you have to like what the Cubs can put on the field, but also the Dodgers and the Nationals. Not to say that next season will be a repeat of this season, because that never happens anymore. But I do think the Dodgers have plenty of talent and they have the right people in the front office.
Yeah, it never hurts to have Clayton Kershaw at the top of the rotation and Corey Seager, a young
That's
player,
right.
playing in the middle of the diamond. That goes a long way in
yep.
making people look very smart or not so intelligent. Let me ask you real quickly, since we are talking GMs. At least right now, and it's recency bias, I have to say, but nonetheless, the track record's looking really good. Theo Epstein has to be seen now as one of the best GMs we've ever seen. Again, I'm not saying that's fair. I'm just saying if you would ask the casual person, I would imagine he'd be thrown in a list of people. He's won with the Red Sox. He's won with the Cubs. Both spend money. So you know, there's that little way of balancing out what you think of him. But I'm just curious, with how well he builds minor league systems, and he really did do a great job in Boston. You can say that you need money to win, and in Boston, Theo had that. And they bought some prospects. Back then, you could buy prospects. You could outspend on them. So he did have that advantage. But nonetheless, he built a phenomenal system in Boston. He's now built a really phenomenal, good young team through a farm system in Chicago. What are your general thoughts on just how good he's been? Is he the best GM in the game, and does he have a chance to be that good? Or again, is this a recency bias kind of examination?
Well, it's good to ask the question about recency bias, because certainly, again, that's a question that might not be as popular if the Cubs hadn't just won the World Series. What if they'd lost in the first round of the playoffs or their first round? Would we be talking about him as much? No, we probably wouldn't be, even though we should be, because the best indicator of a team's performance, of a team's true quality, is what it does during the regular season, and they were tremendous. An amazing run differential. And ahead of schedule. They weren't supposed to be this good, this quite this fast. So just going on the track record of the Cubs the last 2 years, he's done a tremendous job, regardless of what they did in October, which, of course, wound up being pretty impressive. I think that it's difficult to place Theo Epstein in historical context because the job of a general manager is so different than it was when, say, Branch Rickey or Buzzy Bavezzi did the job with the Dodgers. But in the current context, you have to do so many things. You have to oversee a front office of many dozens of people rather than a front office of, say, six people. It used to be the general manager had his farm director, and he might have his what they would call his head or chief scout. That was about it. He didn't have a great deal to do. And, of course, things changed when the draft came in, and things have gotten only steadily more complicated and complex over the years. And they're only going to continue to become more complex with more employees and more things to worry about. And I think what he has done that's most striking is that he has built not only really good team in two places, but he's also built great teams in the front office. And you really can't win. I don't think you can win anymore consistently unless you have a number of tremendous people in your front office who work well together. And I think as much as anything, you know, we talk about, there's been a lot of discussion about Joe Maddon and his ability to hold his team together, to lead those guys. And I think deservedly so. I think Theo Epstein has done similar things, but in the front office. And ultimately, I expect that will be his legacy. When people write books about Theo Epstein, it won't be about, oh, he made this trade, he saw Jake Arrieta before anybody else did, whatever. There will be a lot of that, yes, but I think a great deal will be more management stuff. How did he find these people? How did he get them working together as a team year in, year out? I think that's what he does best.
And it's probably not fair to examine someone's free agent. I mean, Theo Epstein has actually missed on free agents quite frequently. If you're going to mark a negativity or a weakness, sure. He has not made a lot of good free agent signings. And Manny Ramirez was signed by Dan Duquette, not Theo Epstein. Theo Epstein signed about 17 different shortstops, and they all failed. And then you could argue that Jason Hayward signing may be the next one. Those things get overlooked. But I agree. To try to examine a GM by his signings or even his trades, it is tough to look at it that way. I agree with you. They are managing an entire organization and trying to get it to mold together and blend and be successful. I agree with you. You mentioned Joe Maddon, which is an interesting topic. I don't want to ask about him specifically, but when you look at managers, he's one of the common threads with the Rays, and we talked about Friedman, and now with the Cubs and Epstein, he was in both of those places, obviously. What is the role of a manager? And I saw an article written by Eno Saris over at Fangraphs, because he had a Manager of the Year vote, and I find the Manager of the Year voting almost to be a media creation and almost having nothing to do with the reality of numbers or performance. I mean, you look at John Farrell in Boston, and I got to be honest, I don't think John Farrell's a good in-game manager. But nonetheless, he did have two last place teams with Boston, and he gets a lot of blame for that. And yet they go from worst to first, and he gets almost no credit whatsoever for the fact that they came in first place. And if they'd won the World Series, maybe he would have. Maybe because they were so bad in that first series that maybe that's why he gets no credit at all. But he wasn't even in consideration for Manager of the Year, or he definitely didn't win it. What's your opinion on what a manager's job actually is, and what should we be giving them credit for and giving them blame for? Joe Maddon is maybe a great in-game guy, and John Farrell is a horrible one, but yet they both ended up finishing first in the division. And so, I mean, how do we determine what is a good manager and what isn't? It doesn't seem like it's fair, and I don't know how we determine it.
Well, I would agree that it's largely media creation, and frankly, most fans don't really care who the manager of the year was. We know the history of the award is pretty strong. I shouldn't say strong. It's pretty consistent. It typically goes to the manager whose team does a lot better than people were expecting. Well, is that because the manager did something tremendous or because our expectations were off? I'm not sure. I think that the other guys who get it typically are guys who manage teams that win a million games. And that's going to help a guy like Madden, Lou Piniella with the Mariners, the year they won 116, et cetera. Those sorts of things don't happen very often. But they do. I thought Farrell deserved more consideration than he may have gotten because they did go last to first. On the other hand, the Red Sox were favored to win the division by a lot of people anyway, so you could argue that they simply didn't really do much more than meet their expectations. As far as who actually deserves it, what I would like to see if I'm voting is a manager who actually did something that we can quantify. Did he take this player and turn him into an everyday player and after really no one expecting that, and that guy played well? Did he see something nobody else saw? Did he have to manage a decimated pitching rotation and figure out how to cobble together a good enough rotation to win 85 or 90 games? I feel like that typically the voters for that award don't look for many specifics. They look for generalities. They were supposed to win 78. They won 92. Well, by God, that's manager of the year. Well, that's giving a great deal of credit to the manager. I would rather focus on the specific things that he does well. It's like we focus on the specific things that players do well when we're looking at the player awards. And I don't think that happens very often. I think it's almost all about perception.
And that perception is based on a foundation that is created by the media. I've talked with you multiple times. I talked about you, I think, the last time on the show, and I said, I mean, how did anyone think that the Red Sox were going to make the playoffs last year because they had to improve by 20 games? And I could see it. And you said, well, yes, but the numbers and the projections and everyone said that they were supposed to do that. So you know, just looking and doing I think you said the eyeball test. It was unfair, you know, you were right. And by the eyeball test, I knew the Red Sox weren't going to make it. But if you don't have numbers to defend it, then it is just a kind of, I guess you'd say, a guess. It is unfair, and I agree. I don't know. I guess that leads to my next question, which is, a lot of times I like to read Keith Law. I think he's an interesting guy to look at. I don't always agree with him, but I like reading his stuff. And one of the things that he's been saying for years is, you don't invest in middle relievers because they're too inconsistent. But it looks like we're getting, with all the velocity in baseball now and with so many pitchers that are throwing hard, maybe they can't be good starters, but they can be maybe great relievers. Dellin Betances in the minor leagues, he could never throw enough strikes to make it as a starter, and now he's an elite reliever. And it seems like teams are valuing those more. Francona, it looked like, and if you're going to give a manager credit, I think bullpen's maybe the easiest way to do it. There are lots of ways you can do it. And who makes players, like you said, into a much better player than you expected? What manager does that more often? That's something we can probably quantify a little bit. Maybe it's not easy, but you can probably do it. You look at who manages a bullpen, maybe that's the easiest way. Maybe it's not the best way, but maybe that's an easiest way to look at whether a manager is good or not. But then again, if you don't have the relievers, then you can't do it. I think John Farrell gets a lot of partial credit for a manager because they say, well, look at what he had in the bullpen, and you know, what could he do? He didn't have the guys to save the games in the seventh and the eighth and so forth. Is the middle reliever becoming maybe the most important player in baseball now? Francona seemed to almost try to win a World Series purely with his bullpen injuries forced him to have to do that, but how essential is the middle reliever become now?
He's become more important, clearly, but it's not clear how important he's going to be. He would have a significantly greater value if he were used during the regular season the way that Francona used Andrew Miller. Fourth, fifth, sixth inning, whenever the game's on the line, I'm bringing my best guy in. It seems unlikely at this point managers are going to do that for a couple of obvious reasons. One is there's a perception in baseball that two perceptions. One is that players like to know their role. They like to know when they're coming into the game. They like to know when they should start preparing to come into the game. And maybe you can toss that rule out the window for a few weeks in October, but you try doing it in April and May and June and July and August, it might not go so well. And the other perception is that relievers simply can't throw 90 or 100 innings anymore like they used to. And for there was a time, maybe we still are, when a lot of us were sort of poo-pooing that notion. Well, if Dan Quisenberry did it, and if Mark Eichhorn did it, etc., why can't they do it? Andrew Miller do it? Well, the answer might be that Andrew Miller is throwing a lot harder, throwing more max effort pitches than relievers used to. I don't know if that's true. Certainly, Goose Gossage threw max effort basically every pitch, and he threw a lot of innings. But he might have been a freak. It's like when people bring up Nolan Ryan as an example of what pitchers can do. No, that's an example of what Nolan Ryan can do. Most guys can't throw 170 pitches in a start and then come back 4 days later and do it again. So there are a lot of things that sort of militate against a relief pitcher being used in the regular season the way Andrew Miller was used. It doesn't mean it won't happen sometimes. And what you'd like to see, I think, is the best relievers being used, maybe not in the sixth inning. That's probably not going to happen. Maybe you bring your best ace reliever in the seventh or the eighth and not save him for the ninth. I think that's another logical step, and it's more likely to actually happen.
Plus, I think the one thing that makes that decision by Francona a lot easier, is that he had Chad Allen and Andrew Miller. So
right. It's
not like Andrew Miller was your only good reliever and you were going to be stuck with a kind of a nightmare in the ninth. You looked at the Giants.
Right.
They almost beat the Cubs. But if Francona did what he did with Miller, knowing that he had a subpar reliever for the last inning or two, that would make it look a lot more ballsy, I guess I would put it.
That's right.
But when you know you have Chad Allen for the ninth, then moving Miller around becomes a lot easier.
That's exactly right. And of course, every team would like to have two, even three lights-out relievers. And you're right. It makes it a lot easier to be flexible when you have more than one, no question.
And going forward, because the Royals kind of initiated this. Now a lot of teams are trying to load up. I mean, the Yankees had Miller and Chapman, and of course they traded them both. But they were one of them is a free agent this year, and the other one is I believe after next year. So they made a smart choice, but it was one that wasn't all that difficult. It's not like they had these relievers locked down for four more years and decided to move them. But going forward, would you be willing to give 3 or 4 years in really good money to these relievers? Are they that important? Or I remember, what was it, Robertson, when he went from the Yankees to the White Sox. A lot of people didn't like that signing. He got pretty good money in two. Is it only specific relievers that you'd be willing to spend on? Or do you think that it is a prudent approach, a philosophy, to now start giving middle relievers bigger contracts in more years than we've traditionally seen happen?
Well, I mean, the money is almost, I wouldn't say it's irrelevant, but almost every team has more money than they can actually spend. I mean that literally. There's no, they run out of ways to spend the money. You got this drag now on bonuses for amateur players. You got relatively small free agent markets with so many players locked up with long-term contracts that it's tough to find a place to spend it. So if you tell me that Aroldis Chapman's worth $12 million a year or 18, I might say sure. But if someone comes along and gives him 20 a year, am I going to say that's stupid? No. They overpaid by $3 or $4 or maybe $7 million. But if they have the money, what does it matter? Ultimately, yes, these contracts drive up the price for the next player, but what really drives up the price is the fact that the teams have the money to spend, and they wouldn't spend it if they didn't have it. Even so-called small market teams now have payrolls over $100 million. So I don't think the issue really is how much, whether they get an extra few million dollars, and the market certainly is heading in that direction. I think, again, it comes back to what do we do with this guy when he stops pitching as well as we thought he was going to pitch. Are relievers more predictable than they were before? I'm not sure that's true. I would actually suspect that it's not. I haven't seen a study of it, though. I know that if you look at the best relief pitchers in, say, 2013 or 2012, most of those guys weren't the best relief pitchers in 2016, just three or four years later. And I think that pattern is going to hold true. Given what we've seen with all the arm injuries around baseball, given what we know about pitching max effort, how hard that is on a guy, and also what we know, a lot of great relief pitchers, or I should say a lot of pitchers, relief pitchers who have great seasons, part of it's just a fluke. When you throw 60 innings, you have a much greater chance of having a fluky ERA or strikeout rate or whatever than if you throw 200 innings. So it's not hard to get fooled. But you see pitchers with one great year getting a big contract, and that makes sense. It might not. Answering your question, yes, of course they're going to get more money. They're not going to break the bank, but teams that think that these guys will be great for three or four more years, at least half the time, they're going to be disappointed.
So it's really kind of a small sample size, and maybe we're in the era where middle relievers are getting so much notice, but 10 years from now we'll forget. Is that a good summary of what you're trying to get to?
I don't know. I mean, I think we'll forget some of the pitchers, yes. I don't think that we'll forget the middle relievers. The trend is for those guys to pitch, I shouldn't say not necessarily more, but certainly they're certainly be valued more. I think that's probably true. This is not new. We've been hearing the bridge reliever. I don't know if it's still a hot term, but we've been hearing of those guys for at least 10 years. It really became, the Royals' success with their three great relievers in 2014 and 15. That sort of brought that out a little bit, and then of course Andrew Miller's performance in October was tremendous, at least until the very end. But a lot of that coverage, a lot of that talk is driven by events, and I'm not confident those same events will occur, those same sorts of events will occur, say, in 2017.
We're talking baseball with Rob Nyer. You can follow him on Twitter at Rob Nyer. You're listening to a podcast to be named later. I'm your host, Chris Mitchell. You can follow me on Twitter at CJMitch73, or you can follow this podcast over at minorleagueball.com. Rob, before we go on and move on to a couple other topics, real quickly, why don't you tell everybody what you're working on and where you are working? I know you've moved around a lot. I've been following you for so long now. Your resume is longer than mine. But where can they find you? Where's the best way to find your work, and what are you working on right now?
Well, the best way to find my work is to – I hate to plug this, but I will anyway – is to follow me, or I guess follow isn't the right word. Whatever the word is for doing something on Facebook, that's the best way to follow me. I post all my – everything that I publish, I post a link on my Facebook page, not my personal page, but my professional page. So I think that's the best way to keep track. I post everything on Twitter too, but those things can seem so ephemeral. If you happen to miss that tweet, it's just you don't see it. But the Facebook, I think, works pretty well. And I've just been, for the last 6 or 8 months, I've been bopping around doing different freelance jobs. I did some stuff for the New York Times, or Vice Sports. Right now I'm in the middle of what I think is going to be a really fun project for Complex Sports, which unfortunately I can't really talk about because these won't be out for a couple of months, and I don't really want everyone to know what I'm working on. But they have a great site. They don't do a lot of baseball stuff, but when they do baseball, it tends to be pretty interesting. I did a piece for them a couple of months ago, an oral history of baseball and the Seinfeld show, and people seem to really enjoy that.
Let me ask about that without you divulging anything that you're not comfortable doing. What do you think is the most interesting thing about baseball right now? Covering, learning, maybe we're just starting to see it and it's going to develop. What are the most interesting things in baseball from your perspective right now?
I think that baseball is thanks to, I think largely to a younger, somewhat non-hidebound commissioner, I think baseball is interested in making some significant changes to how the game is conducted. And I think it's long past time for that. We're seeing some real efforts to speed up the pace of the game. There's been some talk about getting rid of the four pitches for the intentional walk. There's been some, I think it's serious talk about somehow limiting the number of pitching changes, whether it's in a game or inning or whatever. I don't know if any of those things are going to happen, but there does seem to be a real, it's not an enthusiasm, a willingness to entertain some what recently have been thought of as pretty radical ideas. And a lot of things happen on the field, and they tended to be off the field, the wild card, adding that, and you know various other things, realignment, not much realignment, but a little bit of realignment with the Astros and Brewers switching leagues. But now they're talking about different things that would actually make the game look a little different. And I won't say that this is necessarily a good thing or not, right? I don't know what the changes are going to be, if any, but I think it's exciting that they're talking about them. And for me, I think as I get older, I tend to be more interested in the wider angle, looking at the game as opposed to drilling in on a particular player or you know, strikeout rate for trends or whatever. That's another thing. That's another big story, you know, is the strikeout rates, which go up and up and up. And I haven't heard anybody in baseball talking about doing something about that, but I think ultimately, whether it's next year or in 20 years, baseball is going to should do something to turn the game into a more inclusive sport where you have more fielders making plays and less strikeouts.
I agree with that. I was actually going to ask you about that when it comes to pace of play, because my father gets frustrated whenever a reliever can't throw strikes. He just goes nuts. and it seems like with starting with Moneyball and the focus on walks and on base percentage and all this, more players are willing to strike out. They're willing to strike out looking, or they're willing to just swing for the fences. And to me, it's not, you know, they try to cut down how long these games are. The fact is, they're not going to make a meaningful change to the amount of time a game takes. Maybe they cut 8 minutes off a game. Maybe they cut 12. If you try to tell me, maybe there's an argument to be made there, but if some analyst tries to tell me that shortening a game by 15, 20, even 25 minutes is going to drastically impact whether someone enjoys baseball or not, I find that impossible. I find that an impossible argument to make. To me, the pace of play argument is, I think, what you were saying right there, which is if more players are swinging, if more players are involved, if there's more action going on, I love hockey because it's always going. The pace never stops. It's phenomenal. I don't know why more people don't love hockey. But if you just want to be entertained, it never stops. It might be too fast for you, to be honest. It might be too fast for so many fans. But the pace is fantastic. If more guys were swinging and more balls were put into play and more runners were running, I don't think the fact that the game takes 3:30 or 2:50 makes any difference. That's my thought on it. A, do you agree with me? And B, what does baseball do to force that to happen? Do they enlarge the strike zone? Or I mean, I guess the question is, how do you make a change? And how do you make that happen? I guess.
Well, first of all, I agree with you. The pace of play is more important than time of game. I think time of game does matter, just not nearly as much as the pace. Because I think you're right. I think people will happily sit through a three-hour game that's moving along, where things are happening. As far as how you change that, I mean, it's basically a two-part question. If we're talking about just speeding up the pace of the play, there are lots of ways to do that. And in fact, they've done them. And they have cut time off the games. There was an effort, I don't remember how many years ago, 6 or 8. It was when Sandy Alderson still worked in the commissioner's office, where they actually did some things, basically told people, the umpires and the players, to get it together and stop fooling around so much. And they actually, not necessarily paid the play, I'm not sure they were even tracking that or certainly not reporting it then, but they did cut, I don't remember how many minutes it was, 5, 6, 7 minutes off the average game time. And then they did it again last year or the year before. And they did it by doing more of the same, basically reinforcing the rules about delays. But you could do a lot more. In fact, they're doing them in the minor league with pitch clock. Without pitch clock. Yeah, with pitch clock. And we don't have those in the majors yet because they haven't been negotiated. But when the more players you have who came up through the minors and were trained for the pitch clock, the easier it becomes to convince the current major leaguers that that's something that we should could do. There are a lot of things you can do to speed up the pace of play that don't involve actually changing any real rules on the field. Now, if we want more balls in play, that's a tricky one. It really is. Now you're fooling with some fundamental things that a lot of players are going to really resist. I do think that ultimately, if we want fewer strikeouts, you start by lowering the mound by 1 inch or 2 inches. I think that's the easy thing to do, not legislative, not in terms of the players, because they're going to be resistant to any change like that, but that's probably the way you get your best result, at least without anything truly complicated. We know that lowering the mound has an impact on strikeout rates. We saw it in 1969.
Yes, for me, I want to see more swinging, more balls in play and things like that. And again,
right.
I don't know if that'll make the change, but to me, that seems like the obvious one. It may be obvious and wrong. I don't know, but it seems like that's the easy one. All I know is that my father gets extremely frustrated when we watch games when pitchers can't throw strikes. And even if pitchers weren't throwing strikes, maybe if guys were swinging a little bit more, they would happen. But then again, I get frustrated when I watch Javier Baez swing at the exact same slider 15 times in a row. So
I think they're throwing too many strikes. I mean, the problem is they throw so many strikes, it's so hard to put the ball in play. The walk rates have not gone up. The strikeout rates have gone up. And you look at some of these strikeout-to-walk ratios with guys like Kershaw. Excuse me, he's an extreme example, but the pitchers are just so good. They throw so hard with such great control that it's become, I don't want to say it's unbalanced, because there are a lot of ways to define balance, but if you look at the strikeout rate, it's increased basically forever since day one of baseball, with a few blips in that line. But if you look at the trend line of strikeouts, it's been going up forever. And I do think at some point, is that sustainable? Do you really want the strikeout rate to go up, to always go up? And if you don't, what do you do about it? And I don't see any obvious reason that trend line is going to turn around all by itself.
Last, real quickly, I want to ask you about the awards, and then we'll get you out of here. We're talking baseball with Rob Nyer. You've got a touch-and-feel kind of guy win the American League Cy Young with Rick Porcello over the power guy and Justin Verlander. And then in the National League, you've got Max Scherzer, the power strikeout guy, win over Kyle Hendricks and John Lester. It seems weird that that's how it unfolded. Let me first ask you about Porcello. It seems like all the stats said that Verlander should have won this one walking away, and he got more first-place votes. I'm curious, what are your thoughts on the fact that Porcello won in the Electoral College, but Verlander won in the popular vote, I guess is what people are saying. What's your thoughts on Porcello winning the award there?
Well, I wouldn't agree that Verlander was the obvious choice statistically. I think that you could have made a case for a bunch of guys as having the best season statistically. In fact, what was so odd about this season was that you didn't have a truly outstanding pitcher. I mean, you had a bunch of them, but there wasn't a Kershaw type season. There wasn't a Clemens type season in the American League. If you look at things like FIP or ex-FIP or even wins above replacement, like depending on your source, obviously, you rank the top 5 or 6 guys to each other. There's really nothing to distinguish them. And I think that when you see something like that, where nobody really stands out, and then why not go with the guy who went 22-4? That seems reasonable to me. I think that the problem, not in the minds of the voters, but in the minds of in my mind, you have to downgrade Lester and Hendricks a little bit, just a little bit, because the metrics suggest they had a tremendous defense behind them, and that counts. I think that, you know, Bill James once said when talking about players that everything counts. And when you have what's I think a close race with Scherzer and Hendricks and Lester, you know, close race, you want to look at everything. And the defense was one area where the Cubs just had a big advantage. And I think Scherzer, you know, by any definition, had a tremendous season. I would have been happy with really any of those guys winning. I don't think you can really go wrong in the National League or the American League with the Cy Young Awards.
Let me ask you about that, because a lot of the, I guess, the sexy stats were in Verlander's favor. You went into more advanced ones. What was the stronger case for Pacello? Where do you point to, or what stat do you point to and say, other than wins, because he definitely had the winning, that, you know, and wins, I have a weird opinion of wins. If you quote me wins on why a pitcher is good, I disregard it. But yet, when you're looking at the Cy Young and you say one guy won 22 and one, it's difficult to give Felix Hernandez the Cy Young when he's 11-11. You know, whenever that was a few years back, or Randy Johnson when he was he had like 15 losses, but he was the best pitcher in the game. It is hard to overlook wins, even though in many other ways I do overlook wins. But what's the case for Pacello, why he should have won it? What stat or where do you look and say that's why it mattered and that's why he deserved it?
Well, he had the lowest, for example, he had a lower home run rate than Verlander, not a lot lower, but it was lower. He had a much better strikeout-to-walk ratio than Verlander. I think the people who supported Verlander for the award were focused largely on his superior strikeout rate, 10 per 9 innings, whereas Pacello was only 7.6. But Pacello's walk rate was half of what Verlander's was. That counts, too. But they were very even. You know, they both gave up roughly the same number of home runs, roughly the same batting average on balls in play, roughly the same ERA, roughly the same FIP. I mean, that's why there really was no significant, and I haven't looked at their defenses behind them, so I'm ignorant in that regard. But leaving aside the defenses, there's no appreciable difference in their fundamental performances. So, sure, then why not turn to the guy who was 22-4 and pitched for a division-winning team. It's probably what I would have done.
And to wrap it up, Mike Trout and Mookie Betts, one plays for a winner and a contender, one plays for a loser looking worse and worse every day. Yet Mike Trout overcame that and won the award. Do you think he was the deserving of the award? Were they equal and you just pick one? What are your quick thoughts on that one?
I do think that Trout deserved it. I think we could, if you wanted to make an argument, it might be regarding their defense, because, you know, look, people think of Trout as an outstanding center fielder. The numbers don't say he was outstanding. I'm not saying the numbers are necessarily right. I think that we still have a lot of work to do in our non-proprietary defensive statistics. But they're close enough overall that you could say, well, if we just bump up Betts even more for his defense and downgrade Trout a little bit, maybe we could make a case for him, and maybe you could. But you could also make a case for Josh Donaldson or Jose Altuve if we're going to start doing that. I think that Trout, by almost every standard, was the best player in the league, and I think this should have been his fourth or fifth MVP award, not his second. That's how tremendous he has been. And why did he win it this year, not the other years when he could have? Well, the Triple Crown thing didn't happen this year, for one thing. But as you know, MVP voters have typically liked big RBI guys on pin-winning teams. And Betts was on the division winner, and he did have more RBIs than Trout. But it wasn't a lot more. Believe it or not, the fact that Trout had 100 RBIs rather than, say, 92 or 93 might have made a big difference.
Can you imagine the Angels trading him? I realize that their future doesn't look very bright, but Do you trade Mickey Mantle just because your team stinks? Could you imagine that the Yankees or whoever is loading up and they're actually going to – could you imagine the Angels actually trading Mike Trout?
I can imagine a lot of things, and if only because that sort of decision is ultimately is an emotion-based decision made by the owner. You're not going to trade Mike Trout unless you as a GM convince your owner that it's the right thing to do. That's going to be a tough lift with ownership. It always has been. When you think about players who are untradeable, you know, the Orioles have been better ultimately in the long term if they traded Cal Ripken at some point in the 1980s or 90s. Well, they might have been. They might have been better. They certainly didn't do very well with him, 89 or whatever it was. They made that weird run almost to the playoffs. But you weren't going to trade. It just wasn't going to happen because ownership was never going to allow it. And there aren't many players like that, Tony Gwynn, Cal Ripken, George Brett. There are players who become untradeable unless they want to be traded. I think Mike Trout has become one of those guys through his performance. If you're an Angels fan, you just can't countenance him going anywhere. And that means the owner probably can't either.
Yeah, I wouldn't call it an exact comparison. There's a lot of differences, but Evan Longoria in Tampa Bay kind of comes to mind. Again, not quite the exact same thing as Trout, but he seems like a guy that is not untradeable, but seems less likely to trade for a lot of different reasons.
Well, and the Angels, too, they don't really have any excuse. The Rays at least could make the case to their fans that, look, we're not going to compete this season. We have to think about the future. But the Angels have massive revenue. And there's no systemic reason why they can't be competitive every year. And if you assume you're going to be competitive, as their owner probably does, then you want to keep your best player for as long as you can.
And I think the Rays could make the argument that they're trading Longoria for Longoria. They could say, we're not going to win, and Evan has been such a great player for us and such a good team guy that for his benefit, we're going to trade him to someone who might win. They can at least play that PR game. That makes it easier. We're doing it for him. We're not doing it for us. We're doing it for him. The Angels really can't do that with Mike Trout.
Especially if he wants to go somewhere.
Yeah. All right, that's Rob Nyer. You can follow him on Twitter, at Rob Nyer. You can also follow him on Facebook, Rob Nyer. And it's just Rob Nyer. Just look for Rob Nyer on Facebook. It's just that way.
It is. And I think if you just search for Rob Nyer, you should get the Rob Nyer MLB page or something. So, I want to come on again so we can have exit velocity.
I do. There are lots of topics I wanted to get to, but we couldn't keep you here forever. But you let me know when you're available. I'd be more than happy to talk about the other 14 subjects that we didn't get to because I rambled on topics that we didn't actually plan on talking to at the beginning. You kind of lured me in a different direction, so I'll blame you. But there are lots of other things I'd love to talk to. So you keep in touch with me. I'll email you and be more than happy to have you on as soon as you're available again. But thanks again for coming on today. And everybody follow him on Twitter. But thanks, Rob.
My pleasure. Always enjoy doing it. Thanks.
All right. That's Rob Nyer. Again, you can follow him on Twitter at Rob Nyer. Or as he said, the best way to find him is Facebook. I am friends with Rob on Facebook. And it is a good way to get things. And again, you can get them on the long form. On Twitter, you just get links and little accesses. And like you said, a lot of times everybody's Twitter feeds get lost in the noise because there's just so many people. I follow, I think, like 3,000 people on Twitter. So how many of those I actually see their tweets on any given day? They probably tweet out 100 times, and I see maybe 3 of them. So Rob points that out as well. So if you do want to follow him, and I highly recommend he does, because Rob really does some fantastic work. But I would look up Rob Nyer every single day and see on Twitter and on Facebook what you can find, because when he's writing something, it's pretty interesting. So I highly recommend it. Everybody listening into the program, I appreciate you tuning in today. I'm your host, Chris Mitchell. This has been a podcast to be named later. I put a rundown over on Facebook. Again, Facebook, there it is. If you want to follow this show or get access to the links to what we've been talking about, I post a rundown for all of our programs. It's a podcast to be named later. I listed a lot of topics that we didn't actually get to. We didn't talk much about 2016. We did actually talk about the awards, and that was on the agenda. We didn't talk about the best and worst stories, which I was hoping to get to with Rob, but he was talking about some of the topics early on in the program, and I just wanted to ask him more and more questions on it. So we didn't get to the biggest surprises or the best or worst stories, the biggest disappointments of 2016. We didn't even touch on the hot stove for 2017, so that would have been an interesting topic. I was going to ask him about FanDuel and DraftKings and their mergers, and we weren't able to get to that. I guess I threw Rob a little bit of a curveball today because I gave him a rundown on what we were planning on discussing, and we almost discussed none of it. I would recommend at least going over to Facebook, again, a podcast to be named later. It has the link to the program, and you can partially ignore the topics in this case because we really didn't discuss any of them. But I will also be posting the podcast on minorleagueball.com. That's where I write about Major League Baseball, both from a prospect perspective, but also baseball. I do blog posts as well as articles, and all of these podcasts get linked there. And I will have an accurate I will have an accurate description of what the topics on the program were. So head on over to minorleagueball.com for that. But if you want to follow me on Twitter, you can look up Chris Mitchell, but it's at CJMitch73. I put links for all of the different podcasts I do, whether it's football, whether it's baseball, whether it's prospects, whether it's fantasy, sports or not. So head on over to that. And that's the way to go. But thanks, everybody, for tuning in. Again, let me thank Rob Nyer for coming on today. Did a fantastic job. Always interesting to get his insights on topics. And like I said, I meant to get to a lot of different things, and we didn't get to them. Hopefully, like Rob said, it looks like he's going to – I love when he comes on, and he sounds like he wants to come back on and possibly soon. So hopefully we'll be having him on back on and talk about some of the topics that we didn't get to today. But everybody, enjoy your Thanksgiving. Thanks for coming on board today. Thanks for listening in. Head on to minorleagueball.com or join us on Facebook, a podcast to be named later. Thanks, everybody. Drive safe.